Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 292, my chat with improviser and TikTok viral sensation, Morgan Phillips. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Get a free audiobook download as well as access to hundreds of books and podcasts. I know that I'm always talking about how you should listen to the podcast on there, but there's so many other things that you can access at Audible. There's so many different kinds of books, things that you might not have even thought of that are just free. So you can check them out, and there's just a lot available to you. So if you're looking to consume something different, you know, sometimes you get tired of the podcasts or the TV shows that you're doing and you're like, what can I do that's different? And there's just so many great Audible original things. And you can just enjoy what's free all the time, or you can buy stuff there as well. If you're really into reading, you want to blow through a bunch of books, great. It's easy. It's cheap. It's not expensive at all. So sign up now for Audible and, you know, you can find your way to reading 100 books in the new year. You know what I mean? We all need to be a little bit smarter. Start with Audible. They can help. Okay. Go to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy, sign up, and get your account today. Be smart. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by podcastcadet.com. Podcastcadet.com is the company that my husband Chris and I run to help podcasters. We are available to you to advise you on which platforms you should have your podcast, or, you know, just how to write it, how to sit down and do it, what microphone to buy. We can help with those kinds of things. We just want to help other people because we had to figure it out as we went along. And every time we go to the podcast conventions, people are asking the same questions. And so if you have questions and we can help, please just contact us. We have all sorts of things available on podcastcadet.com. Lots of resources that you can use there for free. If you decide to purchase a service from us, you know, like maybe we edit your podcast or, you know, set you up with a workshop of some kind to teach you about writing or production, you'll get 20% off when you mention the code YBY20. And, you know, we just want to help you. So check it out. See what we can do for you and give us a call, podcastcadet.com. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my resource for vegan-friendly whole plant extract CBD oil. There's all sorts of things at truehempscience.com. Lots of different kinds of products you may have never even thought of that had CBD that you could use. I know sometimes people are like, oh, I really want to smoke something. Great. They have this cool CBD bud that you can just smoke, and it's just chills you out, and it doesn't have the you know, the willies of THC or whatnot. And it's cool. It's like the lotion that I'm always talking about because it's my thing. You know, there's products that you didn't even think, oh, is that how I could, you know, get relief? Or I didn't know CBD could help me in this way. But check it out. There's all sorts of really interesting things. Chris really likes the tinctures, you know, the little droplets that you can have of it in your mouth. He says he loves it. You know what I mean? It could really help you out, you know, maybe ease some pain for you. And this is a great company with a great owner, somebody that we know, right? So support truehempscience.com, buy all your family CBD products for the holiday, and use Yes But Why 7 to get 7% off your order of $50 or more. And with each order, you'll get a free packet of CBD edibles. All right, yum, yum. It's like cookies, but they have CBD in them. It's super delicious. truehempscience.com. This week on Yes But Why, I had the opportunity to talk with New York City-based improviser and improv coach Morgan Phillips. Listen in as we connect about temp jobs, singing a cappella, and being there at the bitter end of an improv scene. Been there. I now present to you Yes But Why episode 292, Morgan Phillips on music, improv, and going viral in your 40s. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I'm very interested in the way that you played as a kid.
First one that comes to mind is Batman and Superman.
Oh.
It was a two-person game where one person would pretend to be Batman and one person would be Superman. I also had a tiny puppet stage or kind of a blind that you could pop puppets up above and
wow.
Kind of collection of puppets. So a little of that. I was a big fan of pretending that the floor was lava as well. That was a favorite game.
That's a classic.
Yeah. And I guess they made a game show out of it recently. So it's been like everything from childhood. It's been monetized now. I did it on an amateur basis only.
It's like indie music. You did it before it was cool.
Yeah. Very similar to that. Same vibe.
Oh, that's funny. Do you have siblings?
I have a much younger little sister, 9 years younger.
Oh, wow.
So I was a very good big brother because I knew that I was supposed to be mildly jealous. Like I knew the theory of why siblings don't get along sometimes. And so I felt more like kind of another parent, but without any of the responsibilities.
Huh.
So we got along great, and I had fun. Kind of, we would play creative little games, like we'd make puppets ourselves sometimes. You know, little sandwich bag or lunch bag puppets. And she is now a professional dancer, so she has a much more challenging and creative life than I do.
For a second there, I thought you were like going to be like, she works for like Sesame Street now. She makes puppets. It was because of me. I did it.
Like, I can take no credit for her in the ballet world. We did zero modern ballet growing up. That was all her.
Yeah. That's a tough one. A tough one right there. So you mentioned you played Batman and Superman. Did you play both roles or did you have like a friend over who did it?
Well, my memory is that I had a friend over, but I guess I could, you know, you can kind of go back and alter those kind of sad, lonely memories. I am pretty sure that it was a real other human being there portraying the other one. I also, I'm thinking about it now. I had one of my coolest toys was working walkie-talkies, one of which had a picture of Batman on it. And one of which had a picture of Superman on it. So I think those probably played into it. And whoever had the corresponding walkie-talkie, that would be an extra sad thing to play with by oneself as well. So I'm pretty sure I had a friend playing using the walkie-talkies with me.
Well, no judgment playing by yourself from me. I have an only child right now. I had a sister, but I have only memories of playing by myself. So I think that perhaps I'm a bad sister and B, totally cool with playing by myself. So no
it's
judgment
an important
here.
Skill. I think playing by yourself is an incredibly important skill to develop, the ability to do that.
Yeah.
Not well, depend
certainly,
on others.
Well, also like certainly to develop, you know, your own imagination from the point of view of like writing new stories. So like right now I do a lot of writing, and if I couldn't play by myself, how could I write? Like I write by essentially having a conversation with myself where I'm like, yeah, that could happen. What else could happen? Oh yeah, she could do this. Yeah, good idea. All right, great. So then, you know, so I'm like playing both sides of the conversation. So whenever I hear my child doing that, I'm like, yeah, that's right. You're doing it. Good job.
Yeah. I was an only child for almost
nine years.
So I got my only child time in there as well.
Yeah.
It's kind of best of both worlds. I got to experience that, but then also have somebody to commiserate with about parents being weird, etc.
Yeah, totally. In fact, correct me if I'm wrong, because math is hard, but that's 9 years without a sibling, 9 years with one, and then you left.
Yeah.
Right. So that's like a solid, that's really solid. Good job, parents, for creating that scenario. And then, so she had her latter nine on her own. Interesting.
Yeah. Mm. But she, so I had the years where, you know, you're a good kid, hypothetically, what, like up to nine. And then she had the years as an only child where she was like the rebellious years. So,
I think our
only child experiences were a little different in that respect.
Yeah, though I think you make a strong point that everyone from 9 to 18 is kind of in the rebellious years, like, and as well they should be. You know, we're all trying to like figure out who we are and, you know, come into our own. I can't believe I'm jumping into this so early, but I will tell you that I have this theory of life. It's going to be hilarious if you like heard it when listening to episodes, but like I have this theory that every 18 years you become a different person. That
I have
like
not heard that, no.
Great. Sorry, audience, you have. But like, so the idea being that like, so from 0 to 18, you're like your parents' kid. You do what they tell you, you learn what they tell you to do, you go to wherever they tell you. And then at 18, they're like, and you are released, figure it out. And then you spend 18 to 36 figuring it out. Like a lot of trial and error, a lot of failure, a lot of ups and downs. But by 36, like you're probably doing all right. Like you figured out what you need to get a job. You figured out how to, you know, move around in the world, talk to people, and you're probably different than you were when you were a kid. You've had so many different experiences, and then you were independent. You were able to make your own decisions. But the other part is, you know, there's not this cultural connection to being older than 36. Like, you know, and by they, I mean like advertisers pretty much focus on 20 somethings and 30 somethings to sell stuff to, right? Even though realistically they should be selling to the 40, 50s because they got all the cash, right?
Sure.
So, but they, after a person turns 40, they're like, we no longer care. But the trouble is we live for a long time after that, right?
Very, very inconvenient.
Yeah. So the existential crises continue, right? And so that's why I'm like, honor your journey from 36 to 54. At 54, you might think things like, maybe I should get a Ferrari and a young girlfriend. You don't have to. If you'd like to, sure. But you don't have to. You're just different now. Now you're going to be older person. Now you're going to be 54 to 72. Like, my mother, when she turned 72, I actually like could sense a palpable difference in the way she dealt with the world. Like, and I thought, wow, like she really has evolved in a new way. And she's trying to move on to her next journey after 72 to be whoever her elder, you know, woman is. And it's like, it's a beautiful thing that we get these journeys. And I always try to, you know, when people are stuck in one or they're in the middle of something, I'm like, hey man, would you be mad at an 8-year-old for not knowing what they're going to major in college? No, it's fine. Don't worry about it. You'll figure it out. You know? So when people turn like 30 and they're like, well, what am I doing? It's like, hey, you get 6 more years to figure it out. Don't worry. And then after 6 more years, you'll be like, I have this new way of looking at the world. And then you become somebody different. Like, it's just about like evolving and ebbing and flowing with the new changes that happen in your life. Right.
Right.
I wonder for you, since you had that 9-year thing, if maybe your journey's 9 years. You know, because it was so formative, this moment of 9 years, that like maybe every 9 years there's like a change in your mindset, or like you mature in a different way, purely just out of, you know, the actual circumstances of your true life.
Uh-huh.
How did for you when you grew up, and did you go to college? How did you claim the world as an adult?
To the extent that I did claim the world, I guess I did go to college. I went to, to Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania.
Right on.
And then and started doing improv in college, and then moved to New York after that. Basically, because most of my friends from college moved to New York, and I didn't know what to do or where to go, and I figured, oh, my 10 best friends from college are in New York. I'll go to New York.
Yeah.
And I had done improv in college, actually improv and a cappella in college.
Ooh.
And picked up with both of those once I got to New York. So I had a period, a long period, about 10 years in New York, where I was juggling improv and a cappella and temp jobs.
I love it. I also worked so many temp jobs in New York City when I lived there. It's the only way, I think. I mean, I actually also think that like temp jobs are the key for all creatives. It's like if you have the possible variable of getting a tour and leaving at any point, get a job you can leave at any point. Right. Like, and with a temp agency, you're just like, hey, Susie, listen, you know how I was working at the insurance agency? I can't anymore. Okay. And they're like, okay, great. Like, they're not mad at you. You know what I mean? Like, it's great. Oh, temp jobs. So fun. All right. I have to ask you, funniest temp job you had in New York?
Well, probably the weirdest temp job I had was at the temp agency itself. I had been working with the same temp agency for probably at that point, I think 8 or 9 years. And the head of the temp agency, it was named after the person. So the titular, I won't say her name, but it's the so-and-so temp agency. She herself saw my resume and saw on it that I claimed to have been working for this temp agency for 8 or 9 years or whatever it was. And she did not believe it. So I got an angry call from the temp agency that she had seen that and was outraged that I would lie about that on my resume. And I, you know, calmly explained, well, I have been. You haven't always been able to get me work, but I've always been registered with you. And the majority of every year I've been on temp assignments for you. So could you double check that? And they did double check it, and they were, I guess, embarrassed. But so somehow as a result of that, I was called in to be a temp for a couple of days to assist the head of the temp agency. And I don't really know what the thinking was. I don't know if that was supposed to sort of make it up for me, or just the head of the temp agency like wanted to see this temp and cause this embarrassment. But that whole time I didn't really know why I was there, and I had not done anything wrong other than work for them for a long time. I should say they really stepped up later. Because their main client was Pfizer Pharmaceuticals. I will name it the pharmaceutical agency. And sure. They had a rule at Pfizer where you could only temp for them a certain amount of time. And then after that, you weren't allowed to be employed by them anymore, because I guess they didn't want to encourage people to just sort of never give benefits to employees. And I was offered permanent jobs at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, but never wanted a permanent job because I always had these creative projects. So once I sort of aged out of Pfizer, they really couldn't find any more jobs for me because I was their main client. So they basically told me, file for unemployment. We'll say that you can get unemployment. So I then was on unemployment because they couldn't find me any more jobs. So it was as if I had been laid off from a job because of lack of work. So they could have just said, well, you're on your own. We can't get you any more jobs anymore. So
yeah.
I was able to be on unemployment while looking for something else. So that was nice. I forgive everything based on that one gesture, but it was still a very weird couple of days where was I trying to impress the head of the temp agency in some way so that something wonderful would happen for me, or was I? So yeah, that was the weirdest temp job I had, I think. I also had a temp job once that in some ways was the best job I've ever had, in some ways was the worst, where it was a powerful executive at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, and he was on vacation, and my job was for 2 days to sit at a desk on a seemingly abandoned floor in their offices in Midtown Manhattan, and sit at a desk, and there's no computer at the desk. And this was sort of, I don't think I had a cell phone at that point. This was probably in the late 90s. And there was just a phone there on the desk. And my job was, when the executive's line rang, to pick it up and tell them that they were unavailable and offer to take a message, which is basically what voicemail is. But I guess it was an important enough person that they wanted a human being to be the frustrating thing and not the voicemail. So my entire job for 2 days was to sit at a desk with no visual stimulation. I think the second day I brought a crossword puzzle or something, maybe even a book, but just that sort of surreal feeling of being paid a decent wage to just sit there and be a human being that maybe 3 or 4 times during the day to tell somebody that the thing they wanted was not possible. And could I take a message?
Oh, so, my gosh. I can't tell you the number of times that has been my temp job at hundreds of different companies. They're like, sit at this desk and just answer the phone and tell them you can't help them. What?
I feel like with most of the temp jobs I had, even if it was one where there wasn't a lot of work, there was that thing where you had to pretend to look busy. Because it looked bad if somebody was just sitting there. But there was no one else around to look busy for.
Yeah.
So I was just sitting there.
Yeah, I have had many where they were like, I was like, can I be on the computer? No, the internet is not hooked up. Okay. Can I read a book? No, you cannot read a book. Okay, a magazine? No, I'm sorry, there can't be anything. Like, all right, great. No problem. Yeah. You're lucky I'm creative. Can I have a notebook? Yeah, sure. Okay. I'll take it. Like, at least I can just write notes and create stories. And then I'm not reading a book, but I'm writing one, right?
Right.
Oh my God. Temp jobs are the best. And they're like such a staple for creatives because it gives you like a job with low stakes and it like allows for you, like I said, to like take off. So if you get a gig or like something happens, like suddenly you have an audition and you can be all like, Susie at the temp agency, I'm not coming in. And she's like, sounds good. Like, I've never had anything but like pleasant reactions from temp people, largely because there's so many people that work for them. They have no idea who I am. So they just take it as like, sure, all right. Yep, you must be working for us. Yeah.
No, the time that I personally offended the temp agency was extra surreal because of that, because I was probably one of at least 1,000 employees, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was the absolutely. One who angered. I angered the titular head of the temp agency.
Oh my God. So tell me more about your a cappella career. I mean, I literally only know about a cappella because of the Pitch Perfect movies. Yeah. I didn't go to the kind of college that had either improv or a cappella. So whenever people talk about doing improv in college, I'm always very jealous. But it makes sense. Like, I've heard of Swarthmore, like I get the improv part, but like, before we get to improv, like, tell me about a cappella.
Well, so it was the first 10 years basically of me being in New York. I was in a professional group, but I was in a group in college for 4 years. And I was always a little embarrassed about it.
Sure.
Just a little bit, because I really enjoyed the experience of doing it. There's something amazing about unaccompanied harmonies with other people.
Yeah.
It's just the feeling of doing it. And that was great. And it was an eight man group in college, and six of us were from the same year. So we were all in it, I guess all 4 years. So I got to know them really, really well. And you know, one of the only groups of people that I do sort of sentimental Zooms with is the people from that group still to this day. But they did deeply annoy me by the time I graduated.
Sure.
Because we spent so much time together. But I still loved this idea of singing with other people. And I graduated college in 1996. So you mentioned the Pitch Perfect series. That didn't come along till later. So
it was well after, yeah,
kind of a shameful thing to, like, some people you would say, oh, I'm doing a cappella, and they'd be like, oh great, and some people are like, oh god, I thought I liked you and now I don't.
I get that reaction with improv sometimes too.
Yeah, and I think improv has had a similar journey. I don't know what improv's Pitch Perfect was, but it's a little bit more mainstream now, I think, than it used to be, at least back in like the early or the late 90s when I sort of started doing it in New York. When I got to New York, a friend of a friend was starting a professional a cappella group, which sounded like a very daring thing to me. I don't think I had ever considered doing that, but I got together with them and we auditioned other people. And over the course of 10 years, we sort of built a name for ourselves as an a cappella group. And this was, we did all original songs. We would throw in a cover or two in each concert, but our thing was we did all original music. And there are groups that do that out there, but especially at the time, there's really only two or three groups that tried to do that. And the reason for that, I think, is because nobody wants to hear original a cappella songs.
Nobody but other artists. That's so impressive. Like the idea that you're like writing your own songs and then like performing them and you're like, we don't need a band. Like, that's amazing. That's, I mean, from my point of view, as an artist, you know, the idea of you creating that is so impressive. And like, what a goal. Like, yes.
It was a purely artistic thing in the sense that, like, it was something that we felt like we really needed to do. And we would have done much better financially if we had just done covers. In fact, we had within the a cappella world, we had a lot of success. But the sort of larger success, the group didn't really see it until after I left, after about 10 years. The group went on without me, and they started really focusing on covers and instantly did much better. Like, I always wanted to tour Japan. That was sort of like the pie in the sky goal. And it was sort of just on the horizon for us for a while. But once I left, and once I started, I mean, I think it's because of the covers. Maybe it's because I left. They honestly did improve musically after I left, because they were so established at that point they could get like really professional singers in there, whereas a sort of whoever happened to be around the first iteration of the group that I was part of.
Wow. So did you guys do like parties and like events, or did you do like Christmas parties at like Pfizer and stuff? Like,
well, never at Pfizer. We did corporate stuff, an increasing amount of corporate stuff the longer that we were around. When we started, we really just did small rock venues in New York City. Sort of venue that any like a small acoustic or plugged in rock band would do, we did as well. We played CBGB. For instance, CBGB is the legendary like punk rock venue in New York. Now, granted, I think it was literally like a 6 p.m. on a Tuesday. and it was towards the very end of CBGB existing. And I don't think we're what drove them under.
No.
But for the most part, it was little clubs in the West Village and Midtown sometimes. And then we did college touring. We took part every year in something called the Harmony Sweepstakes, which is the professional version of the kind of competition they have in Pitch Perfect, as opposed to being college groups. And every year we lost, and we usually lose to like a barbershop group or like a madrigal group. It was any kind of a cappella. So it was a lot of apples and oranges.
Yeah.
But we beat our head against that goal over and over again. But we won some, within the a cappella world, prestigious awards. And we were the the big groups at various festivals. And so within a cappella, if you were a fan of a cappella, professional a cappella between like 1998 and 2008, then you would know my group. So
like 1996 to 2008 in New York, you're doing one of the money-making ventures in your life.
Barely money-making. Yeah, I think it started in 1998. So I'd been in New York for a couple of years when it started up. But yeah, we would make money, but then we'd reinvest it back in the group because we had to have our own sound equipment and we put out a few albums. And so I don't know how much money I legitimately cleared. We did get money sometimes, but I think a lot of it went back into the group.
What was the name of the group?
It was Duende, Duwende. And it's still, they're still out there and they're amazing. And they do, they have a lot of stuff on YouTube now if anybody wants to check them out.
Good old internet, helpful.
Good old internet.
Yeah, like so you said you graduated college in 96. I graduated college in 2000. So we're essentially just a 4-year chunk behind you. But like the idea of making money with singing and making money with essentially like a band, like I definitely didn't do that. And it's just like so amazing. But yeah, a cappella was a thing that I recall hearing about and it being around right around that time. But the reason why I brought up the time was also like the internet is now super ubiquitous, but like at that point it really wasn't. So you could have a YouTube channel. Actually, I don't even think it was invented then. Like YouTube was later, but at the same time, like having videos up of your band was crazy, you know. Unless you had like a record deal, nobody's got, you know, their band's music up and stuff. Like, wow, that's so awesome. And you have albums, dude. Like how, okay, tell me about your thought process when it comes to like, I'm gonna be in like a musical group and release albums. Like you must have such confidence in yourself, like, and the talent to be able to sing, you know, just consistently and create these things and write the songs. Like what drove you to keep this going? Like what was inspiring you and moving you forward in this journey?
Yeah, I have no idea. It was one of those, every once in a while, creatively, I'll just get an idea where it just feels like, oh, I have to do that. And I think that for that period, at least, a cappella was that one of our weirdest songs. We mostly did sort of pop rock R&B stuff, but we had also a French rap that we did that came out of, we were musically improvising in a rehearsal. And one of the members I guess we were in an apartment rehearsing, and one of the members had bought a push-up bar, like a special bar to do push-ups on. And we were just sort of improvising, and I picked up the package, and there were instructions in French, and I just started reading the instructions with a sort of rap cadence, based on my memory of pronunciation from high school French, and we recorded it, and it was like weirdly good. And I remember that as one of those moments where I was like, I think we have to perform this song. So we were in like rock venues, and people go to these venues because it would be a night of bands. So if they were, you know, they'd be there to see us potentially, or just at the bar, or there to see the band after us or before us. So we blew a lot of minds by, first of all, just doing this sort of professional, all mic'd a cappella, which was not as common back then. It was mostly sort of, you'd be in like a kind of like a bell tower or a church, and you'd hear the kind of acoustics of just the bare voice. This was like on microphones, was a slightly more aggressive and loud sound. But we would end every set with this very strange and very energetic French rap song about push-ups. And it really was like, it paid off. In that it was one of those moments where it's like, I think we have to do this very strange thing. I just feel that we have to. And I think that the a cappella thing in general, it was just a prolonged moment of that. It just feels like something we have to do. It's so fun to sing with other people. It's so rewarding we mostly co-wrote our songs. One person would maybe bring in most of a song and everyone else would contribute, or one person would do the music, one person would do the lyrics, or a mixture of people working on it, and to collaboratively have songs exist that didn't exist before and then perform them. I recommend, even if it's not an a cappella band, like any young people listening, I guess old people can do it too, but like start a band. like, you don't have to be good at your instrument. It's, I think maybe a cappella is a good way to go, because if, you know, you don't have to have the skills that an instrumentalist would play. You can pass off a kind of quirky voice as a choice. I don't think you can really pass off quirky, wrong ways of playing an instrument quite as easily. But so, you know, make a band that's like, why would you not do that as a young person with like free time? I mean, I guess, you know, if you have other stuff you have to be doing, but if you have some free time and maybe some money to blow on that sort of thing, start a band. Absolutely. It was because it was basically a rock band. It was just a rock band that a lot of people didn't have any interest in ever hearing, but a lot of people did too. And within the a cappella world, we were, I think, considered legitimately cool.
Yeah. With it, sometimes, you know, as long as you're connected to the niche community, like, yeah, that's all you need, right? It's not really about, if I've learned anything from the internet and even just podcasting, like, sometimes if you just find your group, the people that like want to be your listeners and want to be your fans, like, honor them, like them, be happy that they're there. Absolutely. Love the people that listen. I'm always like, I'm here for you guys. Like, it's just, it's nice to find a group of people that like are into supporting you. So that can for be sure. Really great. And I love that, you know, you guys had some success in the a cappella group. I mean, 10 years, it's like a lot to dedicate to a project, especially one that where you're like, I don't know, it was kind of a whim. Like, is that how your creative vibe is? I mean, did you like get started in doing theatrical things purely on a whim in college?
Yeah, well, I did. I was in the plays and musicals in high school and the choir as well, concert choir. And I never thought of it as something like, I want to be a professional performer someday. Although I will say that I realized when I was a kid, I wrote down at some point that I wanted to be an actor when I grew up, which really surprised me because I had no memory of wanting to be an actor. And I traced back the memory to a conversation I had with my father where he pointed out to me the actor who played that Han Solo and Indiana Jones were the same person. That was an actor whose job was to be those people. And so I figured out in retrospect, I misunderstood what an actor was. I kind of thought an actor was somebody who literally got to like be Han Solo and be Indiana Jones. So I don't think I had any idea of like what being an actor actually entailed. I guess most people who haven't been part of that world don't really have an idea of what it entails as far as like constant auditions and parts that you don't want to take, that kind of thing, or not getting any parts at all. I never really thought of myself other than that childhood thought of, I want to be an actor. I never thought it would be possible to be a professional anything within the entertainment world.
And yet that was the path that you took. Like, you continued to go over and over making these decisions. Like, yes, I will do this. Yes, I will do this. It's fascinating to me that you're not like, yeah. And then once I did it the first time, I was hooked. You're like, I literally don't know how I keep. I have been doing improv for 25 years. I don't know why I keep going back. Like, it's just like a fascinating thing.
I do, I think, know why improv is the only thing that I haven't gotten bored with. Because I think a cappella, I guess, is the runner-up as far as the longest time I've been involved with it. But I've been, like, I was trying really hard to be a screenwriter for maybe 5 years or so. And I don't really want to be a screenwriter anymore. And there's been other things that I've had, you know, a couple of years where like, oh, let me really try to do this. And just sort of lost interest in it. But improv, I think, just by its nature is something that is just so different all the time. And depending on the different people you work with, it can be a totally different experience. So it's almost like, how could you get bored with improv when it's literally the nature of it is it changes constantly.
Yeah. But it still has that similar stigma, like we talked about with a cappella, where like, even though like, you have been doing it for a long time. It's existed for a long, long time. There's been people, cool people, that have been doing it for ever. And yet still, I feel like we have to be like, no, guys, it's good. It's legit. Like, how do you, like, what brings you back to it? Clearly, being cool, not the number one thing. Like, I feel that way. Like, being cool is like 27th on the list of important stuff in my life. Like, I am not interested in people being like, what you're doing is cool. But at the same time, I think it's cool. I really love it. What is it that like keeps you coming back to improv? You mentioned it being fresh and new. What caught you the first time? What was the thing that like first made you fall in love with it?
When I got to college, I went to an improv show with my hall mates, the one improv group at the college at the time. And it was hilarious. They were really talented. And I think I simultaneously thought, that is really funny. And I think I might be able to do that. And then I auditioned for the college group, and I did not get in, which was a major, I was very sad about it. And I, in fact, did not audition sophomore year when the next audition came, because I didn't want to be, this is very ironic in retrospect, but I didn't want to be that guy who auditions all the time and then doesn't get in. I don't know if I knew somebody like that, or just that felt like that was a thing. And I didn't want to be the guy who came back and didn't get in again. But then junior year, I was just, I loved their show so much, and I really felt like I could do it. So I auditioned again junior, and I got in. So I did it in college junior and senior year. And then I didn't think I would necessarily do it when I got to New York, because the idea of, well, I mean, you know, I did it in college, but I couldn't be like, what does it mean to be a professional improviser? And I came to New York in the fall of 1996, which was actually, as it turns out, the same time that the people who formed the Upright Citizens Brigade came to New York. So the state of improv in New York was nothing like it is now, or at least pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
There were maybe four improv groups, and most of them would have like a monthly show. And there, as you mentioned, the internet was not a thing yet. It existed, but not as a place where you could go and look at show listings and that sort of thing. So I would wait for Time Out New York, the timeouts around the world, Time Out New York. And I would look to the comedy listings and literally said, like, oh, there's two improv shows this month. I got to go see those improv shows. As opposed, you know, cut forward 20 plus years, there's literally multiple, I mean, you know, 20 improv shows a night in various venues at least.
Yeah.
So I didn't think there wasn't really that much improv to do, but it didn't occur to me that I could do it professionally. But then I wanted to see it. So I wanted to go to these improv shows. And I went to a comedy sports show. New York had a small comedy sports franchise, I guess. And it was it was in the back of a bar, as a lot of improv shows were and still are in New York. And I think I was one of three people in the audience. And they did an audience participation thing where they were doing, I think the game might have been called Story to Death. It's a short form game where you have a line of people and like a moderator points at someone and they're supposed to speak, and they switch and point at someone else, and that person picks up where they left off. And they brought a member of the audience up, and nobody wanted to go up. And I finally was like, okay, you know, I'll do it sheepishly. And I got up there, and eventually it came down to me and one other member of the group. And it was in my wheelhouse. Like, that's something that is, you know, some parts of improv are hard for some people and easy for others. And for me, that was something that was just like simple to do, to pick up where the person had left off. So I wasn't getting eliminated. And based on like the quality of the show, in my opinion, the person on the comedy sports team really should have taken a dive, because this game was going on and on and on and on. And I think in the moment I thought, well, this guy doesn't want to lose to just some guy from the audience, so he's not going to give up. So eventually I took a dive and pretended to mess up, and at that point, that was the moment where I was like, I think I'm going to try to do improv in New York City. Like, I think, like, these people, this is like a legitimate team, and I'm as good or better than they are, this at least this one discrete improv skill. And that was a little the little nudge I needed to start taking classes and eventually, you know, perform improv in New York City.
It really is a big deal, though. I mean, legitimately, anything that you do in New York, when you talk about it in any other state or country, really, people hold it at a much higher standard than everything else. Like, I produced a play in New York City, and it was like me and three of my friends in like a warehouse. And I'm pretty sure it was just our immediate friends that watched it. But people, whenever they see that on my resume, they're like, really? You produced a play in New York? And I try to explain, I'm like, oh no, it was very low stakes. Like, it was like a, you know, we rented this like random room. Like, it wasn't like a real theater. It was, you know, nothing big. And they're like, but New York City. And you're like, all right, I guess, you know, I'll take it.
That aspect of New York City blew my mind when I moved here, because I was a theater major in college. And it was, I'm sure all theater majors get some version of this, but it was really drummed in my head that theater is this sort of sacred thing. And, you know, the greats of theater are such these amazing figures, and to do it professionally and New York City. And this I think that the sort of the idea of New York City being this temple of theater. And when I got to New York City and I went on a few auditions, it became quickly apparent that in order to like audition people for a play, you just had to put an ad in Backstage or wherever you were listing it. You could just be some person who decided to say, I'm a director, or I'm a playwright or a producer, and I'm doing a play. Where I like, and that blew my mind, because I thought there was this huge barrier to entry, but especially like with things like improv, where you literally can't, I mean, ideally you're doing it in an amazing theater space, but you can do it really anywhere. The barrier to entry for doing improv in New York City is incredibly low. There's a bar that called the Triple Crown Bar and Grill on the West Side, that they let people do shows for free in their basement. And it's just like, you just go into the basement and you just do an improv show, and anybody can do it. So literally anybody can go to New York City and do improv on stage. It's harder to get on to some of the theater stages than others, but the barrier to just doing it, especially now that it's so widespread, is like, so New York, you shouldn't be telling people this, but people, you know, New York is not a big deal, everybody. I'm sorry.
No, it's not. But I mean, I think it's hilarious that it has this high level of clout no matter what you do. Like, I'm like, I really like, even what was it? I have one series of headshots from my 20s that I've popped out, and people are like, where did you get these done? I'm like, literally a friend of mine took it with her camera in an alley. Like, this is not a good photo. And they're like, but it's New York City. And you're like, all right. So it just has this, like, you know, it's almost like Paris, you know, like I in college, I visited Paris thinking, oh, it's going to be romantic and beautiful and wonderful. And instead, everyone yelled at me, go away, American. And it was disappointing. And, you know, I had a rough time when I was there and left early. And I was like, wow, I guess this is a real thing. Like, I imagined this excitement, and you know, it's just a regular place. Where I'm from Boston originally, so I understand when crowds of people yell at you, go away, you know, like that's all right, you know, like I'll take it. Like, I was like, oh you don't want me to be here, got it, I'm fine, I'll get out of here. But yeah, because in Boston there's a lot of yelling, why are you here, please leave. But at the same time, like, though, because I'm from Boston, by the way, when I moved to New York, I'm the only person in the world who was all like, you guys, New York is so nice, like everyone's so everyone's so sweet to me, I don't understand what's going on, no one's angry, what? I feel like, what, it's very rough here. And I was like, no, it's gentle. But that was just in comparison. That was what I knew.
Yeah, I think as long as you don't get in anybody's way in New York, I think you're probably fine. It's just a bunch of people all kind of doing their own thing.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to have your thing kind of be at cross purposes with somebody else's, then you will get yelled at. But not to leave, just to get out of their way.
Yeah.
As a general thing.
I do appreciate what you were talking about earlier, though, the idea of the sort of egalitarian nature of theater, such that any schmo can be like, I'm a director, and like put up an ad and put on a play. And that was always my favorite part. You know, anyone can do this, and like, let's see what people are interested in. And my big thing, the thing that I love the most about doing art and creating theater projects is just seeing what wild idea somebody's got in their head. Like, I loved being part of, I did my main theater thing when I was in New York City was stage management. So I was always essentially right there with directors, just like, what are they going to do? What's going to happen next? Like, what's weird thing is they going to make them do in a minute? Like, I loved it. I thought it was so great. I did so many random plays in warehouses and like crazy basements and like under bars, like you're saying, like such amazing, super fun stuff. And my experience was with a group that did like performance art. Like, I totally should have gotten into UCB while I was there, but I didn't. I didn't know improv was a thing when I lived in New York City. I lived in New York City from 2002 to 2007. So that was my chunk of time, but I did all this performance art group, and the performance art group really set me up for improv because it was an open mic that was a rejection of poetry slams. So it was called the anti-slam. And after every single act, instead of getting judged like you do at poetry slams, the host would say judges and everyone would yell 10. So every performer got a 10. And it was this like big supportive, like rah-rah group that like wanted to like support each other for like creating things. And I was like, this is great. I love this. This is so fun. Like, so when I found improv eventually, it seemed like, oh man, I should have been doing this way before, because I've been into this like, let's support each other, let's like have each other's back vibe for years. You know, I just never saw it in performance, right?
Funny.
So how is your experience in the New York improv world, you know, changed over the years? It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a very long time. It feels like a lifetime now, because I guess it is more than half my lifetime. I'm 47 now.
Yeah,
I came out here when I was 22. I guess I was lucky enough to kind of get here right at the right time to see New York improv go from very little to a huge thing. Because I got here again in the fall of 96, which is when the Upright Citizens Brigade came, the UCB four, as they're called, came from Chicago to New York. And eventually they opened a school, and that became the biggest school in New York. And eventually I started taking classes there. I started taking classes at UCB in 2003, and then became a performer there years later. I was on Harold teams, I guess, for maybe 5 or 6 years. And I was on a musical team there before that. But I was an outsider at UCB for many, many years. I went to see their early shows probably in 1997 or so. And I had a lot of friends who were part of it. But I got into short form improv in New York when I had that epiphany that I wanted to try to do improv in New York. I was drawn to this group, Chicago City Limits, which was at the time the only improv theater that actually had a theater. It had like a very impressive looking theater with a marquee outside and everything. And so when I was deciding where I wanted to take classes, it was pretty much between UCB, which and Chicago City Limits. And UCB did not have its own space at that point. I thought they were hilarious. But I was like, you know what, I'm going to take classes from the group that has its own theater. So I started there, and I kind of auditioned several times there. I auditioned twice, unsuccessfully, which felt like I mean, I had only auditioned once unsuccessfully in college, but in Chicago City Limits, I had to audition twice. Didn't get on either. And then the third time I finally got in. And at the time I didn't realize this would be a recurring theme for me of auditioning over and over again for improv things and not getting in. But so I got into the touring company of Chicago City Limits and then eventually the main stage cast, interacted with, or had a lot of fun with Travis Plager, who was one of your guests a few podcasts ago. He works in Washington, D.C. now. But most of my funniest friends from Chicago City Limits were also involved with or became only involved with Upright Citizens Brigade. And then in about 2003, I realized I really wanted to do long-form improv and get involved with UCB. So I started taking classes there.
Yeah.
And I auditioned for the Herald teams there and did not get in off my first audition. And it was fine. It was my first audition. The audition was, they had two types of auditions there. They had invitation-only auditions, and then they had open auditions where basically the invitation-only auditions, it was as if they had done auditions and then had callbacks. So it was a smaller amount of people. And in the invitation-only auditions, you did a Herald as your audition. With the open auditions, you would do a round of scenes and then select people from that would be invited to do a Herald as an audition. So my first audition, I was an invitation only one based on my performance in classes and sort of word of mouth about me. And right. I barely knew what a Herald was. So that the only thing I remember from the audition was really trying to remember what the structure of a Herald was as I was doing it. And I'm sure it was terrible. And then the second audition.
It's so hard if you don't know what you're getting into.
Until it's muscle memory, it's incredibly stressful to try to do like a very structured long form like that.
Yeah.
If you have my personality type, it's very stressful. I'm sure there's a legend of an improviser. He's one of my favorite UCB improvisers. His name is Charlie Sanders. And the legend about him was that he came into class late one day at an upper level UCB class, and they did a Herald, and he just killed it. And one of his classmates afterwards asked him, "Oh, so have you done the Herald before?" And he said, "What's a Herald?" And so he just, without even knowing that it was a thing, just naturally did the beats in the right order, etc. But my second my second audition for UCB, I think it was, 6 months or a year later, they would have auditions once a year, maybe twice a year. It was an open audition. So I got in past the first round and I got a call back and I again did not get put on a Herald team. And you know, that was two unsuccessful auditions. I'd had that for Chicago City Limits. So I guess, you know, in my mind, I was like, oh, maybe the third time will be the charm. Inconveniently, I then, at the age of, I guess I was 32 at that point, inconveniently, I got cancer. I got Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Oh, no.
And, you know, obviously it came out okay. I'm 47 now and, you know, I haven't had any, it took about 9 months to get rid of it, but I've been totally fine since then. But I had to take a year off of improv. I went back to California and lived with my family and got treatment. And then I came back to New York City and I started taking UCB classes again. And I think this is this probably speaks ill. This speaks poorly of me. as I was sort of facing, this is over dramatic, but as I was facing death, because the first type of cancer treatment they gave me did not work. It worked a little, but not enough for they were like, we're going to have to give you the heavy duty treatment. And until that, Hodgkin's lymphoma is known as, like, I think there's even a Seinfeld episode where they call it like the good lymphoma or the good Hodgkin's. There's Hodgkin's and not Hodgkin's. It's a very curable cancer comparatively. So until the first treatment didn't work, in my mind, I was like, oh yeah, I'll be fine. There's like, I literally, it was like a 95% survival rate for people getting the treatment. But then that treatment didn't work. So they then gave me a backup treatment where there was like a 90%. Survival rate. And so at that point I was like, wow, there's actually a chance I might die here. And I really came like face to face with like, what do I feel like I haven't accomplished in my life that I feel regret about? And I think really sadly, the main thing was not getting on a Herald team at UCB. Like of all the things, like talk about putting way too much pressure on something. Like if a student came to me and told me this story, because I eventually went on to teach, spoiler alert, I went on to teach at UCB after being a performer.
Spoiler alert.
like I would say, where are your priorities? Like you, that's the thing that facing death, you're like, oh, I wish I'd done that. But that, for better or for worse, so I came back after getting cured of cancer, and it was like, okay, I auditioned twice, didn't get in, but I got close. I got a call back, and so I auditioned that third time after I'd taken another class or two in New York, and I got another call back, and I again did not get on a Herald team. And so, cut forward many years in the future, I literally ended up setting the record for number of unsuccessful UCB auditions before getting on a Herald team. I think there are probably people out there who have auditioned more times than I did, but I auditioned 11 times unsuccessfully over the course of about 10 years. Doing improv at wow. other theaters along the way. And I got onto a musical team that was UCB's first musical team. But I kind of got onto that because I kind of knew people and I like understudied. And then they had people move to LA and like, oh, do you want to be on the team? So I kind of got grandfathered in. I hadn't fought my way through an audition to get. So I was a performer at UCB before I got on a Herald team. But that was the thing that I was like the unfulfilled dream of mine. And meanwhile, along the way, they invented another round of teams before you get on the Herald team. They called them Lloyd teams. They were sort of the JV to the varsity of Herald Night. So eventually I got on a Lloyd team and then did well enough in the Lloyd teams that I got on Herald Night. It was absolutely not worth it. In any real sense. I mean, I was incredibly glad and grateful to be on a Herald team because a lot of people wanted to be on New York Herald teams. I can say in past tense now because UCB really does not exist in New York anymore.
No.
It shut down in the pandemic. But
I'm so sorry.
Well, it is
like
it
for you as a person who is so entrenched in that community. Like I remember when it happened and a lot of us all across the world even were mourning for y'all. Like really, we understand how important it was. And it was important to us all in a way that was like so representative of the sort of like heights in which you could go. Even just the discussion, not only of how dedicated you were to the experience, but how the theater itself evolved during the time that you kept trying to get on it to the point where it was like they developed the JV teams, right? Yeah. Because they wouldn't do that if they didn't have so many more students and so many more people vying for stage slots. So like the theater's growing, it's like so important. It was such a big deal. I mean, I have interviewed, as you saw, I've interviewed people all across the world. And sometimes the thing that me and strangers from across the world connect on is like, we both went to Del Close Marathon, or like we both saw ASCAT and at this time together, like, oh my God, you were in that audience too. Like, so it is a big deal. And so I want to say, like, from all of the improv community across the world, like, we're so sorry that your home has crumbled in this way. And we hope that for all of you, all of the New York improvisers that feel homeless right now without a theater, that they like, you guys are able to reinvent and like find cool, amazing new performance opportunities because y'all are great. And we love you. We want you to keep doing improv.
It was a devastating loss personally and for a huge community of people, but it was a very strange combination of that devastating loss because this community had been built up around this theater. Me personally, I had invested 17 years of my life to this theater. I mean, that's overstating it. I did other things in my life. It wasn't 17 years of concentrated effort, but that was the amount of time since I started taking classes there. But it was a mix of that devastation and sort of, it's not there anymore, that sort of disbelief, but also it was, especially in retrospect, a deeply flawed institution.
Sure.
And a lot of that was coming to head sort of in a public way as the pandemic hit and in the time preceding the pandemic. So it's this weird combination of, especially now with some sort of time to think about it, like, yeah, it had to go away to make room for something else. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make the the sort of hurt of having put that much effort and love into something, and then it's no longer there. It doesn't make that better, but it does feel right on a level. So I think I felt very sort of cheated, I think, when it first happened.
Sure.
Especially since I'd climbed the ladder, basically, this ladder that I really wanted to climb on just a personal level. And I felt a lot of kind of ego and accomplishment like wrapped up in this idea of I was a performer. I was still on Herald Night. I'd survived a bunch of Herald cuts and been on, I forget, like maybe five different Herald teams. And I was becoming sort of a senior teacher there, not a truly senior teacher. I've been a teacher for a few years there. And to be able to tell somebody who is at least vaguely aware of improv that, you do improv? What do you do? I'm a teacher and performer at UCB. I felt I got a lot of my self-image was wrapped up in that. And so, but again, it was this flawed institution. So now, like, it is really, I loved my time there and I loved teaching there.
It's only been 2 years. Like, if you haven't truly grieved it, like, you don't have to like try to resolve it in this conversation. Like, and I say that because the theater that I was part of broke up, like crumbled in terribleness 5 years ago, and I'm still grieving myself. Like, yeah. I too felt connected. My personal identity was tied up in this theater, and then, you know, it closed in disgrace when we found out the owners were doing, you know, bad things. And yeah. It was like, I don't know. So what I'm saying to you, like, I see you like trying to sort of find a way to like tell the story and resolve it. You don't have to, like, you can be dealing with this for longer, because it's hard when you dedicate your time to a theater and you dedicate your time to a community, and then the leaders of that community don't seem to care about it as much as you did. It can Sure. hurt. It can hurt so bad.
I think I've also kind of come around as far as feeling, I was a little bitter towards the founders when it first happened. Not as bitter or angry as a lot of people, and it justifiably so in most, if not all, the cases. But I really do have, especially think maybe because I saw it from the very beginning, it really was just four improvisers who had success in Chicago and came to New York to try to maybe get a TV show or that sort of thing. And along the way, they are like, we should teach classes. And then more and more people started taking the class and like, oh, we have so many students and we're paying so much for theater space, we should have our own theater. And so they started their own theater. And then eventually they got a bigger theater. And eventually they got an even bigger theater, maybe too big of a theater on 42nd Street, where way off on the West Side, where nobody really wanted to walk to. But it wasn't like four people were like, we got to start an improv theater. And they grew up, you know, and they had like families, and most of them moved to LA. And like, so on that, I think they nostalgically wanted UCB New York to go on. UCB LA is still a thing, mostly because I think that they live there and they own one of the buildings. But like, it did feel like, especially towards the end, when just the sort of financial mismanagement was coming to light, along with the cultural stuff, it was like, yeah, they didn't want to start an improv theater, really. It was just sort of like, we should start an improv theater. At least that's my take on them. So I, like, you know, it's a really complicated situation as far
totally.
As the structural inequality and inadvertent and purposeful, exclusion. And there's so much, you know, that people can be justifiably upset about. But just on a sort of human level, I feel like there was four people who really didn't want to have a theater there in any sense of like actually running a theater. And as long as it kind of kept going on its own merits, then that was great. And it was a fun, nostalgic thing for them. But I can't, like, if I started something that I didn't really want to start 20 plus years ago, and suddenly it was like coming crashing down and like, I would have to deal with all this like really messy stuff and kind of the financial stuff. I absolutely can see myself being like, somebody else, feel free to kind of take it over. And already there's at least one new theater that has sort of jumped into the fray. They don't have a theater space yet, but a group of some of my favorite people and performers from UCB have started a new theater in New York called the Squirrel Theater. That anybody who's coming to New York looking to check out some improv, there's still some, I mean, the Magnet Theater and in some respects the Pitt Theater here in New York are both around. And I have great affection for both of the theaters as well. And I've done a bunch of shows at both of them over the years. But the Squirrel Theater is sort of like UCB 2.0, hopefully without the baggage, and sort of starting with a group of people that not just want to start a theater, but want to start a theater that has social justice and inclusion at the core of its identity.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, they certainly did not give any thought to that. I don't know this firsthand, but when they started the original UCB Theater, it was like, yeah, let's have a place where we can mess around with our, 100 students or whatever. There were efforts over the years to be like, yeah, maybe let's have like a diversity initiative or something, because that seems like a thing we should do. But there was certainly wasn't in the early stages of the theater, and wasn't anything more than, for years, it wasn't anything more than maybe we should do that. And again, I don't have firsthand knowledge of the inner workings of the theater. I was a performer there and then eventually a teacher there, but it was all sort of rumors and innuendo and speculation as far as what was actually going on behind the scenes. But
yeah,
I like the idea now that with the Squirrel and with hopefully other theaters spring up as well, like this will be from day one. It's not just sort of like, oh, we have really messed up. We need to do something, but to have a fresh start, I think is a really, that, for me, I'm really excited for New York and for improv of what can be in the wake of really coming. It feels kind of gross to be like, it became a problem like a couple of years ago. Like the problem is that it's all these things that have come to light as far as institutional racism and sexism, et cetera. That sounds dismissive, et cetera. Gross inequities and injustice. Those are things that people have been dealing with for years and years. It's only really become a topic of conversation amongst everyone in the last couple of years, but it's been like, that's the real tragedy of it, is there've been so many great performers who have not felt welcome over the years. And just that I love, one of the things, maybe the main thing I loved about teaching at UCB, if I had to say those one main thing, was just being around all that talent, because New York City draws talent from all over, and UCB was the biggest theater. Whatever you thought about the relative qualities of theaters, I would argue it was the best theater as well, quality wise, but I'm very biased. It was definitely the biggest theater. So it had the most people there, and just by virtue of numbers, had the most talented people there. And to think of all the people that fell by the wayside because of institutional BS, is just really sad. This is really sad. All that like wasted potential. And I hope that whatever forms up in the place of it, that's no longer a thing. I'm sure there'll be some version of that that we'll look back on in horror, hopefully not 20 years from now, but it's built into the theaters, hopefully now, especially from what I've seen of the Squirrel Theater, that things will be addressed as they come up. It won't be a sort of like, oh yeah, we should do like, let's start an initiative about that. Let's get an unpaid person who's willing, who like has an interest in it, to like kind of take care of that, so we don't have to feel bad about it on some level anymore. Or so we can point to something and say, oh, look, we give X amount of scholarships, we're in the clear. It's as these things come up, as it turns out that there's some sort of injustice going on, I feel like the systems are there now to like actually take that seriously and quickly work to make things better. So that's exciting. Just as somebody who has seen improv in New York go from virtually nothing to all over the place all the time.
Yeah, man, what an evolution that you've witnessed. Like, what an interesting journey. And, you know, to your point of the changes that have been made, like, I think that during the pandemic, there were so many of us that just didn't have stages to be on. So we all went to the internet and started talking to each other, and the open communication across the country, across the world of like, hey guys, I'm in this Zoom room and I want to let you know that like these terrible things happened to me. And people were like, what? Wow. I did not know. And then just because we all had the time and the access to one another, I think that helped us to open our minds and to like make the changes. And to like, there was a cultural shift during the pandemic as well, where it was like, no, this isn't just a thing we can solve with the scholarship. This is an everyday constant situation where we need to make sure that the community represents where we are. And in New York is such a diverse place. New York is such an amazingly diverse place. Like, I learned about so many different cultures I had no idea about when I lived in New York, that like, yeah. Even now, like, I live in Texas. There are a lot of people from Mexico here, but in New York City, my Spanish speaking friends were not from Mexico. They're from Puerto Rico or DR. And like, I'm like, what? You guys aren't from DR? Oh, that's all I knew when I moved here. I just thought everyone, they're like, we're bordered with Mexico. Of course they're from Mexico. I'm like, I don't know. Everyone that I met that spoke Spanish was from all over. Like, that was the beauty of New York. There were just so many different people. And I think that because we had that time, that moment, that pause to talk to each other and to say like, we were being mean, and we like improv as a group doesn't want to be mean. We want to, yes. And we want to provide a good, fun space for people. And if we're doing the opposite, gosh, we have to run in the other direction and just make it better.
Especially for improv. Because obviously these sorts of conversations are happening in every, you know, part of society and every artistic part of society, but it's really humiliating for improv.
Yes.
It would be just as bad or worse in improv, because it makes it all seem like a lie. Like the real fundamentals of improv, they should preclude any sort of not supporting other people. And it's just, I mean, you know, obviously that's always a fantasy on some level, or like a goal to attain, you know, to strive for in improv. I think there are some rare performers who, just talking about improv now for a second, there's some rare performers who really are that giving at all times. But I think even the best of them occasionally will be, you know, have like a negative thought in their head, or like subtly shut down something from someone, just as sort of a human nature kind of thing. But
oh yeah, ego's big.
Yeah, yeah. But even given that allowance, it's almost like being in being a magician who thought magic was real, and then finding out that it's like, oh, it's been tricks this whole time. Oh no, but there's still a magic element. No, it was tricks. I feel bad, you know. So it's not just excluding people. I think it's extra sad, because I think there's been a lot of people over the years who had that love for improv that every improviser has. There's that thing with, maybe this is true with all art forms or a lot of art forms, where especially when you're starting out, you're just so into it and so passionate about it. You just want to do it 24/7. And my experience of that was so privileged, in that nobody ever made me feel like I shouldn't be doing it. So to have to deal with, like, to have that passion for it, and then that, it's just gross. And it's really, so I'm glad at least there's a chance for a fresh start in New York. Like you said, New York City, there's an extra layer. I mean, smaller town improv theaters don't get a pass, but it feels like New York City, the responsibility to have have diversity be at the core of everything you do, it's just like so weird and disgusting that it wasn't in retrospect.
For sure. It's the cultural mecca of this, of our whole country. Yeah. Like, and yeah, it stands for something. And I'm sorry if it doesn't want to stand for it, but it does. So it needs to step up and do that thing. Like, and I'm so glad for the new group at Squirrel Theater that they're like taking the torch and they're like, we're going to do this. We're going to make a good, welcoming, open community. And that's, yeah, that's admirable.
And I hope they get a stage of their own soon, because that's the next thing. I mean, just, you know, getting, you know, with COVID trying to navigate that, but even just the, I don't wish the task of finding a permanent physical space on any artist. That's very hard. It's much easier just to do it in the basement of bars.
So
I'm glad I don't have to figure out that part of the problem.
You know, post-pandemic real estate everywhere is really crazy. Like, I don't know how, in a world where so many of us didn't have jobs, suddenly everything costs three times as much. Yeah. Like, even in Austin, my husband and I were looking to buy a house. And then right when we got to the point where we're ready to be like, okay, let's do this, every single house in the entire city tripled in cost. Wow. Like, and we were like, whoa, okay, we are not paying that at all. We had this much money and not this much money. And what's going on with this? So New York is already exorbitant. I can't imagine how it has increased by purely just the idea of, you know, the way it works when you're like a person who owns a building and you want to rent out that building. And now you're concerned, oh God, is the business going to close? What if there's another pandemic? Like, all of that stuff freaks out people who own buildings. And so then, you know, it's going to make it so much harder for theaters, because they're like, you're not a permanent situation. You could go away any moment. Like, it's, man, yeah, it is probably the hardest part. The business of theater is harder than the art itself. Sure. Always. So one last question I want to ask you is kind of about how you have evolved. Like, what are you doing right now in your own path? What's the thing that you're doing creatively that, you know, is taking the place of what UCB gave to you, and what are you creating now?
Well, I do have a history of doing things, even though they're mildly embarrassing, to admit it in public, like an early adopter of a cappella and improv. I don't know if it takes the place of, but it's definitely been a sort of creative outlet for me for the last 6 or 7 months. I have become an old person who makes TikTok videos.
Oh.
I had thought that TikTok was just dancing. And it turns out that there's everything on TikTok, including comedy. Uh-huh. So I have been making a lot of TikTok videos. Now, in the last 3 months, I've done fewer. I did hardcore for 4 or 5 months, but I had my first child 3 months ago. So that has curtailed a bit of my TikToking. And I have vowed as a comedian to not become a dad comedian who just makes jokes about, you know, being a dad, because I feel like that's pretty much covered.
Good luck.
Yeah. So I've been struggling to find subject matter for the last 3 months, and also the time to make TikTok videos. But there is something, there's a collaborative aspect to TikTok videos that I find intriguing, where you can make your own standalone video, but you can also do response videos to other people's videos and what they call a duet video, which is sort of like a Zoom where the pre-made video is playing and you record one that plays at the same time. It's not improv. It's not exactly like improv, but that idea of being inspired by something that someone else has done really kind of tickles that improv part of my brain.
Yeah.
Watching videos with the idea of what about, it's sort of the way that you might watch a monologue if you're doing an improv show where the scenes are inspired by monologues, or whatever you're deconstructing up at the top of a long form improv show. Watching TikTok videos with that mindset and then creating content based off of that. And it's immediate. I have gotten over being afraid to see myself on video. For years it was like, but once you have made like thousands of videos of yourself, which I will cop to, it's not embarrassing anymore. So I'll just make a TikTok video and throw it up there. And some of them get 70 views. I have my most successful video was me doing a duet with somebody making a product at Taco Bell and going on a rant about how corporations are exploiting their fast food workers and making them make TikTok video. And the punchline is that the actual original video, it was somebody who had like snuck into Taco Bell and at the end throws the taco down on the floor and stomps on it. And the humorous part of my performance was acting as if that was a surprise to me, and my entire thesis had kind of gone out the window. It's much funnier than it's actually, it wasn't that great a video, but it got 10 million views on TikTok. So awesome. It feels very affirming in that way. So it takes care of, it scratches that itch of responding to someone else's input and coming up with comedy, and also the sort of ego gratification that I desperately crave after not being on a stage beyond Zoom yeah. for the last couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. Plus the nice thing, I am also older. And so I'm like, TikTok, I don't understand how that works. But as a forever artist, I am like always fascinated by the new incarnations and by the way that the newer generation will find a way to create stuff. Like I used to be very, I'm not going to say against, but kind of like turned my nose up at reaction videos. Like I was like, okay, whatever, I get it. But it was like, I needed to find an artist that I enjoyed watching react. Right. So it wasn't that the whole art form was not something that I was interested in. It was that the ones that I kept seeing were like, well, I don't care what she thinks. But then there's a reaction. There's a YouTube series called Twins is the New Trend. And it's these two boys who are probably 19 and they listen to old songs and they react to it. And watching them listen to like Genesis or like Phil Collins and react was the best thing I had ever. I was like, I love them. I love watching them experience this. I love that it's for the first time for them. And I get to see that real reaction. And like you're saying, like it scratches the itch of a live performance. It scratches the itch of an improv scene where somebody says something to somebody and you see them go like, oh, I didn't expect you to say that. Like, right. But then they deal with it. Like something so interesting. I think it's really just a matter of, I try to stay as distant from it as possible from my own personal feelings, just to honor the new art as it comes out. And I love that how you explained that TikTok isn't just for dancing, because like, I can see how people would think that, because that's the most popularized videos that you see. I was actually teaching a Zoom comedy writing class to a teen during the pandemic when TikTok kind of became really big. And I was like, hey, tell me about this TikTok. I need you to explain it to me. And you're 16, so you clearly understand it. And she was so eloquent when she was like, there's different channels, there's different groups, and you can do any kind of video that you want, but it tends to fall into one of these various categories. And I was like, wow, what an understanding of it. Like, and also the idea that there's thematic ways for people to create art on it. Like, oh man, say what you will about the younger generations. They make beautiful art and they work so hard at like putting stuff out there. Sometimes I'm like so impressed, they use the internet in a way that we don't even understand because it's so ingrained in them. And it's like, oh, so exciting and impressive. So like, good for you for having a TikTok channel that's like, can like you're doing stuff.
And, you're literally the only person to have said that to me. Good for me for having a TikTok channel.
Well, I'm supportive of all art. So there you go.
I do think that improv will be online. in the future, like as a thing, not just as an alternative thing, but what I've seen of the technology so far, it's not great yet. Doing a Zoom improv show is just not the same thing as doing a live improv show. But already there, around the edges, there are some technologies that make it a little closer to it, and even interesting in ways that on a stage can't be. And just the ability to do it virtually for free, to not have to have that physical location, and to be involved with people all over the world.
Yeah.
That for me is a really compelling, and you have to think that, I don't know if it's 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we're going to have the ability to have something that is as visually satisfying and experientially satisfying as a live thing. I don't know if you have to think that. I do believe that. And this is coming from somebody who has been very excited about the potential of virtual reality since like the early 90s, like, and thinking it's just around the corner, and it's still not where I imagined it back then. But I really do. I mean, even like you mentioned, being, you know, getting in touch with all these people from all around the world because of the technology now, like I'm occasionally coaching a group in Canada now on Zoom, even, you know, even now that they're back to doing like live shows, they're like, oh, we can, you know, get a quick tune up from Morgan before our show tonight. Like, so I have, for instance, I have a rehearsal with them scheduled for tomorrow from like 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Like,
love it.
Just the logistics that would go into even coaching like a live group in New York. I'm coaching one live group now. It's my big like voyage into Manhattan. I'm working from home other than that. but to be able to just be like, yeah, oh, I have a free hour, you know, at this random time, I can work with a group from another country, like that, but multiplied by the joy of being able to do something that feels like a real improv show. It's just some barriers to entry. I think it'll help with that as well. Obviously there are barriers to entry with technology, especially if you need like a really like super fast device to do whatever this magical thing I'm thinking about is, but less than the barrier to entry that exists for physical theaters, I think, right now. Because you have to have the disposable income to take classes. You have to have the time to be able to devote. I mean, really, to get on a team, I don't know if it's like this everywhere, but in New York, the way to get on a team is to take classes, but also just to sort of schmooze and hang out and meet people. And if you have to work a full-time job and maybe, you know, deal with a family as well, or two full-time jobs or whatever you have on your plate, there's real barriers to entry that I feel like, you know, maybe it's not going to happen for, you know, 100 years, but I feel like we're always 5 years away from being able to do it in a satisfying way online. But I think we're closer than most people think, even
Definitely.
Though, cause I was a theater major and I, you know, I have respect for the art of the theater. But I just love doing it. And I think it'll be really intriguing very soon. Just the leaps forward that were made during the pandemic, plus new technology coming along, I think it's going to be really, I can't really imagine what it's going to be right now, but I think it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you, Morgan, so much for being on the podcast and chatting with me and exploring all sorts of different parts of your career. I really appreciate you for talking to me and sharing your stories and even answering some of my sillier questions. So thank you so much.
It was really fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.